podcast listeners, this is Ann Althaus, your podcaster, your blogger. How are you? It's Thursday the 19th. Next week is Thanksgiving, but you're not supposed to go anywhere for Thanksgiving. You're not supposed to get together with anyone for Thanksgiving. So you'll have to give thanks in some other way. Hold on. You'll be fine. Let's see what's in the blog material today. The first thing I wrote about was the Washington Post viewpoint on obscurity. Quote, for 3 hours, an obscure county board in Michigan was at the center of U.S. politics. That's the front page teaser, along with the headline, Wayne County Republicans ask to rescind their votes, certifying the election result, which links to an article titled, Wayne County Republicans ask to rescind their votes, certifying the election results. Close quote. I said, Wayne County is Detroit. Wayne County is not obscure. Or, I see the ambiguity, is the Washington Post calling the county board level of government obscure? Obscure everywhere. Everywhere there are counties. There are no counties in Washington, D.C., so the narrow viewpoint from Washington may be that counties don't matter. No counties in Washington? Is that news to you? But there were once counties in the District of Columbia. Here's a map from 1835. That's from Wikipedia, which says, quote, the county of Washington was one of five original political entities within the District of Columbia, the capital of the United States, formed by the Organic Act of 1801 from parts of Montgomery and Prince George's County, Maryland. Washington County referred to all of the District of Columbia on the east side of the Potomac, together with the islands therein. The bed of the Potomac River was considered to be part of Washington County as well. Originally, Alexandria County, D.C., formed the portion of the district west of the Potomac, ceded by the Commonwealth of Virginia. Alexandria County, including the city of Alexandria, was returned to Virginia by Congress in 1846, leaving just Washington County. Within Washington County, there were two incorporated areas, the city of Washington and the city of Georgetown. At times, the rural parts outside of the cities were referred to as Washington County, but all three were part of the county. Upon the passage of the District of Columbia Organic Act of 1871, the three governments were unified under a single district government and made coterminous, ending Washington County's separate identity. This law brought the entire District of Columbia under the control of a territorial government headed by an appointed governor, an appointed 11-member council, and a locally elected 22-member assembly. Two of the 11 council seats were reserved for representatives from the district outside of the cities of Washington and Georgetown. 3 years later, Congress abolished the territorial government in favor of direct rule over the district by an appointed 3-member commission. Close quote. Back to the current news. What did these obscurities in Michigan have the gall to do instead of accepting the news from Washington that the election is over? Quote, after 3 hours of tense deadlock on Tuesday, two Republicans on an election board in Michigan's most populous county reversed course and voted to certify the results of the presidential election, a key step toward finalizing President-elect Joe Biden's victory in the state. Now they both want to take back their votes. In affidavits signed on Wednesday evening, the two GOP members of the 4-member Wayne County Board of Canvassers alleged that they were improperly pressured into certifying the election and accused Democrats of reneging on a promise to audit votes in Detroit. I rescind my prior vote, Monica Palmer, the board's chairwoman, wrote in an affidavit reviewed by the Washington Post. I fully believe the Wayne County vote should not be certified. I felt misled, Palmer told the Post earlier on Wednesday before signing the affidavit. I stand firm in not certifying Wayne County without the audit, close quote. Hours before signing the affidavit, Palmer told the Post that her experience on Tuesday night had left her shaken After the first voting against certifying the results, a parade of activists and election workers spoke to the board, with many accusing Palmer and Hartman of racism for calling into question the results from majority black district, black, from majority black Detroit precincts. And I just said racism. So the pressure, if they didn't certify, they were called racist. They felt pressured. And then they took back their certification. And so now it seems to be open again. So how is all of this fighting the election working? I know people want to talk about it a lot. And I'm waiting to see the good evidence. I'm waiting to see the cases that Trump is bringing. I'm waiting to see them presented in a way that seems rational and orderly and evidence-based. So I noticed when Trump put up a tweet at 7:59 this morning, important news conference today by lawyers on a very clear and viable path to victory. Pieces are very nicely falling into place. Now, later in the day, Rudy Giuliani held a press conference, and I've put the whole press conference, which is over an hour, the video of it, I embedded that at the blog, and I listened to part of it on the radio when I was driving in the car today. I thought Rudy has some evidence that things were amiss in various places. And I think that's important, whether or not enough things have gone wrong to actually make the difference in the election. I think we should look clearly and soberly at whatever happened, especially things that couldn't have been anticipated before the election. I mean, we should always be working to try to make the elections properly conducted and honest and clear. And I don't know if they're going back to generic things that could always have been said about elections being imperfect or genuine fraud. I heard some of what he was saying sound like there were some poll workers who were instructed to do things in a fraudulent way. There may be some of that. I want that to come out clearly. I thought Rudy was a little hard to listen to. He had a desperate sound, and he would randomly say harsh things that weren't really necessary, like referring to Democratic officials in some places as, I think he was referring to Democratic officials, goons. He used the word goons. You know, he made some just, it didn't sound as evidence-based, but just sort of like everybody knows they're corrupt in this or that place. And I didn't think that was helpful in convincing me, at least. I thought he sounded too desperate as opposed to staunchly legal and evidence-based. That's what I would like to hear. I can't watch the entire press conference, or I'm not going to watch the entire press conference. And I know a lot of mainstream media will not. Well, much of what he was complaining about was that the media aren't listening to him, that the evidence is there and they won't write about it. I know that's a problem, but he needs to deal with that by presenting legal questions in a way that sounds legal, that sounds solid and sober, and really tracked onto law and evidence, and not swinging wildly, not making vague accusations, not referring to things that everybody knows, such as there's corruption in this or that city. I don't know if he can pull that together. I'm glad to see that. I mean, I'm not glad. I wish everything was just run properly. I know things can't be done perfectly, and I'm satisfied to see the fight go on, hold these officials to the requirements of an honest, sound election. Go ahead and do that. There is a litigation phase, and Trump is choosing to engage in that. He's doing the recount here in Wisconsin. I know it's a recount limited to my county, Dane County, and also Milwaukee. Well, do it. Prove to me that something is wrong, or you'll be proving that something is right. And either way, it will be good. And I can wait to find out the outcome of the election. And I think people should be made to feel secure. Don't make wild accusations that make people feel insecure for no reason, however. And if it turns out that that's what you've done, that will count against you. So we'll see. We'll see what you're able to do. I'm waiting. Let's see. What else do we have today? I'm going to read the one that follows best next. Let's stick with Trump. Oh, this goes back to the election. This is a column in the New York Times by Thomas Edsel. The far left is the Republicans' finest asset. An intense battle between moderates and progressives has already spilled into the public view. And I broke out a quote for the headline, and it's a quote from a University of California, Irvine, poli-sci professor named Bernard Groffman. And Groffman said, "Defund the police is the second stupidest campaign slogan any Democrat has uttered in the 21st century. It is second in stupidity only to Hillary Clinton's 2016 comment that half of Trump's supporters belong in a basket of deplorables." And Edsel also quotes from a report by four progressive groups, New Deal Strategies, Justice Democrats, Sunrise Movement, and Data for Progress. And their report, it's a 7-page report, it's called What Went Wrong for Congressional Democrats in 2020. And this is a quote from that report. "The latest choice for Democrats to locate our fear and blame is the slogan from many Black and young activists who marched the streets this summer, defund the police. Conservative Democrats may change the terms, and people we blame and fear year by year, but Democrats must take on the Republican Party's divide and conquer racism head on and not demobilize our own base. This election, the Black youth leading the Black Lives Matter movement have turned their power in the streets into votes. When Democratic leaders make unforced errors like showing off 2 Sub-Zero freezers full of ice cream on national television or cozy up with Wall Street executives and corporate lobbyists while Trump tells voters we are the party of the swamp, it's not surprising that we lose," close quote. And Edsel links to an especially good Trump ad which magnificently exploited Pelosi posing with her refrigerators. Who knew ice cream could be portrayed as so elite? I mean, it seems to me ice cream is just a very ordinary dessert that pretty much every American can have access to. I think the problem was that she had 2 refrigerators, and they were Sub-Zero refrigerators, which are really, really expensive refrigerators. So probably 2 $20,000 refrigerators, something like that. And she did have an expensive brand of ice cream. I mean, I think most people at a certain level buy ice cream that's that expensive and they don't eat a whole lot of it. It's very tasty, high-quality ice cream. I don't think it's so awful that she's eating that. But boy, her discussion of her love for ice cream, which she was doing to try to make it seem like being stuck at home with the COVID lockdown isn't really that bad because you can have some simple pleasures. You can have some guilty pleasures. And hers was ice cream. And that probably seemed down to earth to her, but it's just that she had such nice refrigerators and she had 2 refrigerators. I mean, who has 2 refrigerators? I mean, some people have an old refrigerator out in the garage, so they get a new refrigerator and they keep the old refrigerator because it's actually really hard to give away a refrigerator. You ever try to give away a refrigerator? When I redid my kitchen, which was way back in 1991, I had a refrigerator that worked perfectly fine. I was just getting a better refrigerator. In fact, I was getting a Sub-Zero refrigerator. It was very expensive, but so I just wanted to, someone like Goodwill won't come pick up your refrigerator, didn't back then at least, was a perfectly fine working refrigerator, and they wouldn't come get it because if your refrigerator is older than 10 years old, they wouldn't get it. I did eventually get St. Vincent de Paul to come over and get it, and it made me really like them that they came and got my refrigerator because it wanted to get rid of it, and it was perfectly good. I don't know how old it was, but it was older than 10 years. I knew that. Now, my Sub-Zero refrigerator that I got installed in 1991, I still have it. It's almost 30 years old, and it's fine. It looks like new, works really well. I recommend the brand, you know. It lasted. It lasted. But if I wanted to give it away, even though it works as well as it always did, I couldn't give it away. I couldn't get the Goodwill type place to come over and pick it up. Anyway, I'm off on a sidetrack. I just think having a lot of ice cream in the refrigerator wasn't a big deal. I can understand why she thought she was just being nice and down to earth, showing that she liked chocolate ice cream or whatever, and that she had some nice brands of ice cream in small containers. But boy, did the Trump administration put together an effective ad that cut in the bits of her talking about her ice cream. And I said, anyway, which side does Edsel take in this question? Remember, the question is the far left versus the moderates in the Republican Party. How are the moderates and progressives going to work out their intense battle? And I'll just quote Edsel's last line, quote, "Liberal advocacy groups have become more in your face, more intense, partly in reaction to the intransigence of the Trump regime, a development that is in turn irrevocably linked to the intensity of the conflicts across the country within the Democratic Party itself." Close quote. And I said, Trump only gets credit when it seems like blame. Oh, he's intransigent. But what Edsel is admitting is that Trump suckered the Democratic Party into fighting itself. How do you do that? It was quite a bit more sophisticated than just being intransigent and thus causing other people to become more intense. Close quote. I mean, intransigence. Right now, Trump is being accused of intransigence because he's not giving up in the election. He won't concede that he's lost yet. He's still fighting. Okay, so he's intransigent. All right. Well, then, if he's intransigent, that makes them more intense. And they get intense, liberal advocacy groups have become more intense. And the intensity of the conflict in the Democrat. Well, if Trump's intransigence causes the Democrats to get intense amongst themselves and fight with each other, then why isn't Trump smart to be intransigent? I mean, intransigent. It's a funny word. I'm hearing it a lot. Trump is intransigent. It's sort of like incorrigible. He's incorrigible. But if he's causing the opposing party to behave badly and fight itself, then what's the problem? Isn't he behaving well by his own standards politically? I don't get it. Everyone always wants to say that Trump is bad, but sometimes they're saying Trump is bad in a way that if you look at it, think about it, it means that he's good, not bad. He's being effective. He's pushing his cause effectively. And I can see why they get very annoyed at him for doing it. Look how bad you're making us be. You're terrible. You're making us terrible. What an absurd fight. Well, I see the Washington Post has an article on the gambling about whether Melania Trump will divorce Donald Trump. Vegas may be betting on a post-presidential divorce. But Melania Trump seems all in for her husband. And I just quoted Melania Trump's chief of staff, Stephanie Grisham, who was asked to comment on speculation that Melania will divorce Trump. And she said, "This question is pathetic and exactly why people no longer trust mainstream media. No legitimate journalist would ask this." Now notice that the headline in the Washington Post says Vegas may be betting on a post-presidential divorce, but Melania Trump seems all in for her husband. So it's not like they're buying into the idea that there'll be a divorce. They're in fact saying she seems to be married to her husband, which is kind of an obvious point. Why don't we have articles about how other people are married to their spouse and don't seem to be doing anything about it? Well, you could say, why would that be an article? Why is that newsworthy? I mean, what makes it newsworthy is that that Vegas is betting on it, that people are talking about it. People are just speculating out of the idea that they've looked at her and they don't think she loves him, or how could you love him? Or they're just making stuff up, just making up a story about her. They don't have anything more than that. But why would the Washington Post write an article about that? And at least they sought an answer from someone on Melania Trump's team. But why were they writing about it at all? Obviously, they're trying to sort of make it seem newsworthy by the fact that there is betting on the subject. Well, so can we legitimize any subject by having people gamble about it? Something private to you, something that you have done nothing, no action to start to do. You've given no indication that anything is going to change, and it can become a story if people start taking bets on it. I don't know. I think Grisham got it right. It's pathetic and exactly why people no longer trust mainstream media. No legitimate journalist would ask this. They're just looking for bad things to say about Trump. Really turns me off to them. You know, I didn't vote for Trump, and I'm not really a fan of Trump's politics, but the way he's treated just makes me push back against that kind of treatment all the time. Well, I think I've gone through all of my Trump topics. Yeah, I have one topic about Matt Iglesias leaving Vox, and then I have something about the school shutdown in New York City. So bear with me. Matt Iglesias left Vox recently, and I haven't really gotten into all the details of why that is, but I see he has an article today that at his new place, which is called Slow Boring. And I see there that he's saying there's a lot of demand for me to address the situation at Vox in detail, or to assimilate my personal story into a larger narrative about wokeness or the culture wars. Yeah. I mean, that's why I'm looking at it. I'd like to see that. But he goes on, it's a long piece. I guess that's what slow boring means, that it's a slow, boring piece. Why? Is that smart? I'm going to be boring. I'm going to take this very slow, but I'm getting a little exasperated. Tell the story. Put it clearly. Speak as if you want to get your ideas across. Let's hear it. But he goes on to say, personally, I'm not a huge fan of navel gazing, so I'll just say this. I'll just say that my personal interest in reclaiming my status as an independent blog-like voice transcends any particular issues with any particular publication. I wanted to do this, not go find a different job. And I thank those of you who've joined me on this journey. And I said, are you a fan of navel gazing? I looked up navel gazing in Wikipedia. Navel gazing, or omphaloskepsis, is the contemplation of one's navel as an aid to meditation. The word derives from the ancient Greek words omphalos, literally navel, and skepsis, literally viewing, examination, speculation. Actual use of the practice as an aid to contemplation of basic principles of the cosmos and human nature is found in the practice of yoga or Hinduism, and sometimes in the Eastern Orthodox Church. In yoga, the navel is the site of the manipura, also called nabhi chakra, which yogis consider a powerful chakra of the body. The monks of Mount Athos, Greece, were described as omphalophys, let me see. Amphilocycians by J.G. Minujin, writing in the 1830s, who says they pretended or fancied that they experienced celestial joys when gazing on their umbilical region in converse with the deity. However, phrases such as contemplating one's navel or navel gazing are frequently used, usually in a jocular fashion, to refer to self-absorbed pursuits. And I said, as long as Iglesias brought up wokeness, I just want to say that the jocular use of navel gazing is a microaggression. You've got an unexamined premise that there's something backward about Hinduism or the Greek Orthodox Church. So what am I trying to say here? I'm certainly trying to say I didn't have the patience to read Matt Iglesias's article. And first of all, why he writes really long, but he's also saying he's not a fan of going deep and personal and becoming all self-absorbed. But people are asking him to talk about his situation, why he left Vox. And I'd like an answer to that, but I only have so much patience. And if you're not a navel gazer, then why aren't you giving us the short, sweet, pithy, direct story? Why aren't you giving us that? And to say, well, I'm not a fan of navel gazing, is sort of a polysyllabic, elaborate way of saying what? Saying, I'm not going to tell you. That's from, I remember when Chief Justice Rehnquist, shortly before he died, and people were trying to get an answer out of him why he was, basically whether he was dying. And he said, that's for me to know and for you to find out. It's something we used to say as kids. It's for me to know and for you to find out. And he shortly thereafter died. He knew. And they would find out, and they did. I'm not a huge fan of navel gazing. Well, navel gazing. That's kind of an old-fashioned expression. Do people still say that? But I've always thought there was something a little offensive about that. I mean, he's talking about wokeness. There's a larger narrative about wokeness or the culture wars. Does he really get into that in his slow, boring article? I don't even particularly know. But how did I want to say this? I don't really know if he got into that, but I don't know why putting down this religious practice along the way is something you need to do. I mean, if you're concerned about wokeness, you know, why not look for the endless things that you can do wrong in the name of wokeness? I don't even know what his position on wokeness is. I don't know. Maybe he wants to be less woke. I saw an article in the New York Times today, I almost blogged it, about a professor who had decided to be critical of the call-out culture by starting a new culture that was the call-in culture, that we won't call people out, we'll call people in. I guess there was something inclusive that you were still being woke, you were still kind of calling them out, but you were doing it in a way that included them and embraced them. I don't know. I don't know what everybody's position on wokeness is. But I'll be woke enough to say, possibly somewhat jocosely, but not entirely jocosely, that I do think that the expression navel gazing is a microaggression. Because it's making it seem that Hindu meditation or Greek Orthodox meditation, in some cases, is absurd, like a big waste of time. Staring into your navel and thinking about that, it sounds like a complete waste of time, but it is an actual practice that is done in some quarters. And I've got a picture of a set of statues from that are currently on display at the Louvre, and they're called the navel gazers. They're kind of chunky men bent over at the waist looking down. I know they sort of look like they're looking at their genitalia, so that provoked many jokes in the comments, but the word is that they are looking at their navels and gathering the wisdom that is to be found there. Wool gathering, lint gathering. My mother used to say, And when we think of these expressions like that's for me to know and for you to find out, my mother's, when asked a question, would like to give the answer, that's for little girls like you to ask questions. In other words, as if the mysteries of the world had all been, you want to know why? The answer why is so that I would ask questions. And I knew it was, I knew I was getting blown off by being told that, but it was a cheeky way to say what? I still don't know, quite know what that meant, but obviously it was a way to say, I'm not going to answer your question. You know, I'm just going to throw it back at you. That's you asking a question. And so, I don't know, is that what Matt Iglesias is doing? I'm not really a fan of navel-gazing, so I won't think through anything. And yet he is thinking through something because it's a very long article, and I didn't read it. Now I see that he wants to get back to something like blogging. What was the exact expression that he used there? Let me see. No. Sorry, I don't want to... There is a lot. There it is. He said, I'll just say that my personal interest in reclaiming my status as an independent blog-like voice transcends any particular issues with any particular publication. Well, I'm glad to see the return of blogs. And why not just say blog? What is a blog-like voice? So he's at Substack now. So is a blog? It's not a blog. I think the main thing that's not bloggy about it is that these are that the people who are doing that, some of the others are, who are the others? Andrew Sullivan. Sorry, I won't try to name names, but they're writing long, like magazine-length articles, and so it doesn't come across as bloggy. It's not short and punchy. Blog-like voices. Are they blog-like voices? I think they're magazine-like voices. And it's a blog-like form because it's self-publication on a platform. And yeah, I don't think it's all that blog-like because it tends to go long and be a long article. And I think, is there enough individual style, enough... counter major media, new media. Is there enough of a new media feeling to be called bloggy? I feel like I'm an expert on what a blog-like voice is. I mean, I've really written a blog. I've done it for, I guess I'm closing in on 17 years, every day, writing it every day, and not trying to get into some other format, but just being a diehard dead-end blogger. Yeah, it means a lot to me, so... I feel like I know what it is, but I can't claim to be the final arbiter of what counts as a blog-like voice. But one thing I would say to Iglesias and others is if you're trying to reclaim the feeling of the blog, say things clearly and sharply and get it out there and engage us. Don't just brood more elaborately. Especially don't brood elaborately and claim not to be a fan of navel gazing. That bothered me. Anyway, I got one more to go, I believe. Or do I? Did I do them all and just forget? The question is, oh yes, the one that I haven't done yet is the one about the schools. What caught my attention was a very short article in the New York Times called New York Schools Shutdown Explained. But there wasn't much of an explanation there. I was so annoyed. Here's a quote from this little piece. The mayor's 10 a.m. news conference yesterday was repeatedly pushed back and finally began at 3 p.m. At a separate news conference earlier in the afternoon, Governor Andrew M. Cuomo shouted at a reporter who asked whether schools would remain open. While he was speaking, the Times reported that schools would close on Thursday. Many parents depend on their children being in school for at least part of the week in order to work. Educators and parents also criticized the city for not improving remote learning, even though about 70% of children already take online classes full time. Some students, including those in homeless shelters, have not received iPads or laptops from the city. And teachers have said some students struggle to log on. And I said, where's the explanation of the shutdown? I went to that article because it's newer than this other New York Times article, which I'd already read, and which gives the foundation for the questions I hoped to get answered and absolutely did not. And quoting from that article, virus transmission. So here's some material from the earlier article, and I'd read that, and it made me think I needed some more answers. But I didn't get answers in the newer article. So from the older article, virus transmission in the city schools has remained very low since classrooms reopened at the end of September. And the spike in cases does not appear to be caused by the opening of school buildings. Our schools have opened and have been remarkably safe, the school's chancellor, Richard A. Carranza, said Wednesday. Still, the city is choosing to end in-person learning while the state is allowing indoor dining and gyms to remain open at reduced capacity. Non-essential workers are also continuing to use public transportation to commute to offices. That dynamic has infuriated parents run ragged by fluctuating school schedules and has frustrated public health experts who have been pushing for more in-person instruction. Across much of Western Europe, bars, restaurants, and theaters are closed, while elementary schools at least have remained open. Mr. de Blasio has put school reopening at the center of his push to reopen the city, and he's repeatedly said that remote learning is inferior to classroom instruction. The mayor and the teachers' union, the United Federation of Teachers, have faced intense criticism as the 3% closure threshold drew nearer. Mr. de Blasio has said repeatedly that the union had not pressured him to set the threshold. So this idea of if 3% of the tests come back positive, that'll be a trigger point and the schools will close. And de Blasio ended up following that. But it was apparently some kind of big struggle where he and the governor got quite angry and the time for making the announcement kept getting pushed back. So what exactly was going on behind the scenes? It seems like a bad decision to close the schools when these other things haven't been closed. Gyms, indoor dining. What was the other one? Non-essential workers on the public transportation. And I said, the new article, the one promising an explanation, doesn't even mention the teachers' union. It looks to me as though the 3% positive testing rate was arbitrary, but the union insisted on it, and de Blasio bowed. Where's the science? At least give me some political science. Just 2 days ago, the New York Times ran an op-ed by a pediatrics professor, which I blogged. Schools should be the last thing we close, not the first. Why do we keep asking children to bear the brunt of a lockdown? The professor, Aaron E. Carroll, said, quote, almost everything else should be put on pause first. This is what Europe is doing. No one can explain why, once again, the United States is choosing its own path, close quote. And I said, no one can or no one will. As in the Post, I said, my hypothesis would be both Europe and the United States are putting the interests of adults first. And the difference is which adults, parents or teachers. Yesterday's drama in New York City strengthens my hypothesis. I'm so irritated with the New York Times' avoidance of the subject as it's proffering New York schools shutdown explained. I went looking for elsewhere for a video of Andrew Cuomo yelling at a reporter. I want to read between the lines. What's his problem? Coronavirus science or the political power of teachers? So what a mess in New York. Maybe things have changed throughout the day. I don't know. It seems to be one thing that they're trying to do is get things more shut down to really sell the point that you cannot do Thanksgiving, right? If they're letting gyms be open, if the kids are going to school, people are going to start to feel freer. And it's like, oh, why can't we do Thanksgiving? Thanksgiving's important. But if they start closing down more and more, you got to take this seriously. I think that may help keep the Thanksgiving explosion from happening. Meanwhile, for all this direness about coronavirus, and I know I said this yesterday, but I want to say it again, which is, hey, we got these vaccines. Two companies have come up with a vaccine. What a great triumph of human ingenuity. Why aren't we expressing joy and feeling great about this? Is there some need to feel terrible these days? I know if it bleeds, it leads, and our obsession with the news is making everything darker. But why can't we even hear the good news? What a wonderful thing, how fast they were, how great this is.